from KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Jay Barrett. Coming up this week, with Donald Trump soon to take the president's office, is the Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay now a fait accompli? The people of the Mat-Su discuss their dwindling salmon runs, and there's a new man at the helm of the Bering Sea crabbers. All that and more coming up on the Alaska Fisheries Report.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amsea.org or 907-747-3287.
Well, next week, the Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers will have its new executive director in place. The trade group announced a couple of weeks ago that Tyson Fick will be joining the organization starting on December 1st. Fick spent the last 6 years as spokesman for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Previous to ASME, Fick was the legislative liaison at the Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development and a legislative staffer before that. Fick will establish an ABSC office in Juneau, which will be in addition to the main office in Seattle. Organization President Cale Garcia said that Fick brings tremendous skills in seafood marketing and policy advocacy to the organization, and that she's looking forward to having him on board. Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers is the major trade organization representing crab harvesters fishing for king, snow, and beardeye crab in federal waters off Alaska, and is actively involved in scientific research, policy development, and marketing. It's been 4 months since the fishing vessel Alaska Juris sank in the Bering Sea, and the U.S. Coast Guard is still trying to figure out why its engine room flooded, forcing 46 members to abandon ship near Kiska. Lieutenant Arvin Garcia leads the investigation division for Coast Guard Sector Anchorage. He says investigators have scheduled 2 weeks of public hearings in Seattle to determine why the 220-foot trawler went down.
What has happened since the sinking is that the investigation team has identified witness and has developed theories as to what caused the sinking. And so the hearing, it's in like in a public forum to interview these witnesses and to fully explore those theories.
Those theories won't be made public until the hearings next month. Neither will the names of witnesses. But Garcia says there's a reason the interviews are happening in Seattle.
That's where the vessel is homeported. The owners are homeported there. And a lot of the crew members are from Seattle.
If investigators find the flooding was caused by human error or wrongdoing, the Coast Guard can impose fines or take action against the mariner's credentials. Garcia says it's hard to predict how much the investigation will reveal because they cannot examine the sunken vessel.
That is a challenge for us. So the witness testimony is going to be really important for this case. So we can get an insight as to what the condition of the boat was, what was the overall work climate of the boat.
The Alaska Juris was owned by the Fishing Company of Alaska. Another FCA ship, the Alaska Ranger, sank and killed 5 people in 2008, while the National Transportation Safety Board determined the company failed to maintain a third vessel, the Alaska Spirit, when it caught fire in 1995. The company did not return phone calls seeking comment. Witness hearings will begin on December 5th. The Coast Guard is working to finish the Alaska Juris investigation by July.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
You're listening to the Alaska Fisheries Report. Hear the whole show online anytime at kmxt.org. The Matanuska Susitna Burroughs Annual Salmon Symposium brings together researchers and conservationists for updates on how to better manage and protect salmon habitat. The event was last week in Palmer. Howard Delow is vice chair of the Burroughs Fish and Wildlife Commission, which is organizing a salmon research plan for the borough. Delow says there are many reasons to protect the valley's salmon runs. One is economic, because healthy fish runs add to the area's economy.
That's the tourism effect. the bed and breakfast, the gas stations, the grocery stores, the restaurants, the fishing tackle shops, the guides, they're all being impacted because it's like coffee. If you can't get your coffee here, you're going to go somewhere else. If you can't get your fish in Matsu, you're going to go somewhere else. And that has a decided economic impact.
Poor king salmon and silver salmon returns in recent years have worried state and borough officials. In fact, Dilo says the measurement of sports fishing activity in the Matsu has decreased by about half since 2008. Dilo says informational meetings like the Salmon Symposium can help bridge the divide between sport and commercial fishing interests. The symposium does not take a political stance for or against any of the salmon fishery user groups. Setting fishery allocations is the job of the Board of Fisheries, which has to balance the health of the salmon resource with the demands of the various user groups for a share of that resource.
But where they actually can help groups like the commission, when we're going to the Board of Fish, if they've got some science that says, look, we need to do this for the health of the resource, they're not advocating, they're just making a flat scientific fact. And that's how the board should be moving ahead, is protecting the resource first. Then you can go fight over who gets how much of it.
The Matsu Borough in recent years has had to advocate for more help for area salmon stocks that are in decline. Of the 13 salmon stocks of concern designated by the Board of Fish, half are in valley streams. A stock of concern is one that fails to maintain specific yields or harvestable surpluses despite management measures. Dilo points out that Susitna Yentna sockeye have been on the stock of concern list for about 8 years. Alaska has 33,904 miles of coastline. That's more than the rest of the United States combined. For a long time, there has not been much information available to researchers or to the public about that shoreline and about the fishery habitats that exist there. ADLG's Avery Lill has more about a project that gives people the ability to research and explore the coast, maybe where their set net site is, from the comfort of their computers.
ShoreZone is a project that provides photo and video footage of the coast of Alaska. They passed a benchmark last month. Imagery of more than 90% of Alaska's coast is publicly available online, sort of like Google Earth Street View, but for the coast. The project began in British Columbia in the 1970s. It came to Alaska in 2001. Kelly Ingram is the ShoreZone Partnership Coordinator for the Nature Conservancy.
You're able to fly and see images from the coastline and then see a ton of other data about the habitat, the substrate, the wave exposure, erosion potential, lots and lots of other data.
In order to map the shoreline, a team flies in a helicopter along the coast at low tide. They fly 300 feet off of the ground and 300 feet from the shore at 80 miles per hour. A photographer takes photos every 3 seconds, and another crew member takes video. There are a variety of uses for such imagery.
First off, it provides a baseline inventory of the coastline. This really provides really detailed information about the geology and the species that are there along our coastline so that it can be used for oil spill response planning, can be used for looking at climate change and how things are being affected along our coast. It can be used to look at fish habitat areas, or it can be used to plan your kayaking trip, or, you know, if you're going out on your boat fishing or something like that.
The remaining 8% of Alaska's coast that ShoreZone has yet to map is going to be difficult terrain, Ingram says, but teams are at work on it right now. David Ward is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geologic Survey and the Alaska Science Center in Anchorage. He uses ShoreZone in his research in southwest Alaska. He maps the distribution and abundance of eelgrass in the Yukon Delta, Togiak, Eisenbeck, and Alaska Peninsula National Wildlife Refuges.
So it helped us to supplement some areas where we lacked insufficient data for mapping, or just further helped us to refine our mapping of eelgrass in those areas.
ShoreZone photographs, video footage, and data are free and available online at shorezone.org. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs, 1-800-992-4960, or online at alaskaboat.com.
As a candidate, President-elect Donald Trump said he'd liberate business by striking as much as 70% of federal regulations. Trump vowed to dump Obama-era policies and unleash industry to produce more petroleum, coal, and maybe even gold from the Pebble Prospect in Bristol Bay. It would seem like good times for natural resource extraction in Alaska. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Trump will find some policies easier to dismantle than others.
President Obama's policies for Alaska are embedded in a variety of documents: executive orders, memoranda, agency action, and formal rules. Some can be undone with the stroke of a pen. Consider the Pebble Mine, a massive project proposed for southwest Alaska that opponents say is a threat to the salmon runs of Bristol Bay. Pebble spokesman Mike Keatwall says it's unlikely Trump would want to continue the EPA's effort to block the mine using the so-called veto authority in the Clean Water Act.
Mr. Trump campaigned on halting and reversing the EPA overreach across, you know, the country.
Heatwall says he doesn't know if Trump has specifically taken a position on Pebble, but he says he sees no reason why Trump's EPA wouldn't just reverse course.
Certainly the EPA's, you know, preemptive actions against Pebble, could probably call it a poster child in that regard in terms of EPA overreach.
Earth Justice attorney Tom Waldo also says there's nothing stopping the EPA from making a U-turn on Pebble.
Yes, I think it's entirely possible that EPA in a Trump administration may choose not to continue the process.
Waldo says he hopes Pebble won't get the financing it needs to proceed, and if it does, it will still need federal permits.
There are laws that protect the resources in Alaska and in the United States, and there are procedures that agencies are required to go through in making changes, and we will be vigilant to ensure that the laws are obeyed and the procedures are followed.
It takes a lot of work to overturn a policy that has already been set by a rule.
That's Tom Lorenzen, a Washington, D.C. lawyer at the firm Kroll and Mooring. He used to work for the government defending EPA regulations.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been through two transitions from Clinton to Bush and from Bush to Obama, both inside the Department of Justice, and it is not as easy as people might lead one to believe.
Case in point, the roadless rule for national forests. President Bill Clinton's regulation lives on despite the Bush administration's best efforts to kill it. We'll see if President Trump takes a stab. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by AK Teach, now enrolling K-12 homeschool students throughout the state of Alaska, creating partnerships that are flexible, family-friendly, and unique to your child. More information is available at AK Teach or at 907-942-0667.
And that's all for this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from KUCB's Laura Craigle in Unalaska, KSKA's Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, KDLG's Avery Lill in Dillingham, and APRN's Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. From KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.